Good evening. Welcome, everyone. I want to start by really thanking our sponsors for this evening. I want to thank Larry and Jonathan Kirshner, who are generously sponsoring this year. And the shiur this evening by Rabbi Eisen is sponsored in memory of Lara's parents, Joel Glazer, Yoel ben Esther Rachel Malka, and Irina Glazer, Shlom Tzion Malka bat Sara. And we hope that all the learning that we're doing this evening is li'ilui nishmatam and really serves as a merit to their souls. I also want to mention on a personal note that when we originally came into the community, that Lara and Jonathan can testify that they were really a little bit of a cushion for us. We were just coming in, and in particular, my son was starting a summer camp program. We were like right off the boat, other than the boat. Everything of that is true, but we had literally just moved into the community, and our son Bitzala was starting a summer program, knowing literally no kids in the community. And had it not been for carpools and your daughter being there is just a sort of an opportunity for him to transition the community. I think he might still be throwing that same temper tantrum that started just a few summers back. So it's really been a wonderful opportunity for us to connect, and thank you for your friendship and for your support this evening, and really just so honored to have your partnership and to have you sponsoring this particular opportunity. So I want to thank you really on behalf of Koala. Thank you so much. Our topic this evening is certainly a crucial one. Of course, the relationship between Jews and Christians has a really fraught history. There's no question about it. And yet, despite all that complex history, there's really been a sea change, and we're quite familiar with it. Since the post-World War II position paper on the part of the Vatican, Nostra Aetate, as well as a number of other really revolutionary positions that the Church has taken in other parts of the Christian community, our relationship with that part of the world has still remains complex in many ways, that at the same time certainly has transformed in so many others. And so ironically, whereas previously, among many scenarios, many points in history, the key question was really, how do we relate to such abhorrent violence, anti-Semitism, such prejudice? Where do we even begin to engage? And frankly, very often, how do we survive? How do we simply make it through as Jews in Christian lands? Now, in many scenarios, in many circumstances, really that question has been turned on its head. And sometimes the questions are, at least theologically, no less difficult. Certainly existentially, a little bit easier to handle, but theologically really challenging, and pragmatically as well. How do we engage with people who had previously been our enemies over the course of so many, not just centuries, but really millennia, and now things have changed? How do we engage in those relationships? How do we build partnerships? What are the limits to those partnerships, given some of the theological differences and really chasms that exist between Jewish and Christian theology on very fundamental issues? And these are really, really key questions and hard questions that we continue to grapple with as a community. We're really very fortunate this evening. We have Rabbi Chaim Eisen here this evening, and there's perhaps there are very few people who are really better qualified to share both from the perspective of Torah scholarship as well as personal experience as to a theological perspective and a little bit of a personal perspective as well on these kinds of conversations. Rabbi Eisen is the founding dean of Yeshivat Shorashim in Yerushalayim. You can participate online. Everyone's welcome to join as well. Just go and see the website for yourself. Rabbi Eisen earned his smicha from Yeshivat HaKotel, and along with that, a degree in biophysics from Columbia University. And in particular, in addition to all of his outstanding scholarship, he's published on the Maharal extensively, as well as a range of other areas in Jewish thought. He's begun to be involved in these conversations. He's going to share a little bit of that experience, a little bit of a basis for that, as well as, in particular, he's going to hone in on the question of sort of the notion of the long-term relationship between Jews and Christians, in particular the question of Olam Haba, where we see those of other faiths with regard to that question. And really, he's going to start with those experiences that he's had and segue into that larger theological question. So really feel very fortunate and honored. And it's been a pleasure to get to know you by Skype first, right? First, and now in person, and looking forward to a continuous relationship. So thank you so much. Please welcome Rabbi Chaim Eisen.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Sinensky. And indeed, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I've certainly heard very much about what Kohelet is doing, and it is a zechut to be able to participate in the Binyan Torah of Kohelet. So, as indeed Rabbi Sinensky proposed, I'd like to first share with you something of what my personal niche includes, and why in particular the question of Olam Haba is one that I regard as so very germane to this dialogue. Now, admittedly, there are myriad domains that not only deserve but demand treatment in considering the broader issues that Rabbi Sidensky introduced. But given that our time is nonetheless limited, if I could share with you as a kind of initial foray into the subject, an experience that I had some weeks ago, that is actually was the Shabbat before the last one home in Yerushalayim prior to this lecture tour. So we spent the Shabbat with a large group of pastors from Europe through an organization with which I work in Europe, Christians for Israel. Without going into details of the organizational affiliation, the same organization was having its board meeting at a different hotel that weekend, and after wrapping up with Havdalah for the pastors, we scooted off to this other hotel in order to meet with the board. And most of the board members we've already had an opportunity to get to know fairly well over the course of the last several years. When they asked me to make my presentation to the board, because the meeting was billed as Ask the Rabbi, and that was what it was indeed to a great degree, I began my comments in almost exactly the same words that Rabbi Sidensky used a few moments ago. Since World War II, on manifold planes, not only in the Vatican, Jews and Christians have been coming together more and more. But the supreme irony of these encounters is that, for the most part, when Jews and Christians have come together, they have done their level best to ignore the big elephant in the room. The elephant being their religious identities. Because it's awkward, it's unpleasant, we have religious identities that are so mutually exclusive, how are we going to come into the same room together? So we kind of tried to sidestep the fact that we are not only religious, but animated by our religious identities. And as I expressed it that evening, the problem with that is, I know for myself, if I come into a room and leave my religious identity outside, then I'm still outside. And for devout Christians, that is obviously the same as well. So how are we going to come into the same room and actually come into that room? What's the problem? The problem, perhaps most acutely, lies in the question of exclusivity. That on one plane or another is, in varying degrees, but nonetheless always endemic to religions. We believe, on some plane, after all, that we have the way. Well, all religions believe they have the way. So if everyone has his way, and those ways are mutually exclusive, then there is no way that we're going to come together in the same room and actually confront this massive elephant. As a result, one of the most fraught questions that everyone tries to avoid is the question of the salvific dimension, the extent to which we regard one religion versus another religion as the basis of attainment, of everlasting life, personal salvation, what we would describe as a share in the world to come. It also entails, as a veritably inescapable corollary, the question of contributing to the final redemption of the world. And perhaps I should note right from the outset that in speaking of Olam Haba, inevitably we are tacitly addressing both of those domains. Because when we speak of Olam Haba, just what do we mean? Well, the short answer is my favorite three-word answer to any question. It's machloket. That happens to be a dissension, at the very least, among the Rishonim. I think the antecedents of the diverse positions are to be found in the Gemara and the Midrash, with respect to what we mean by Olam Haba. Is Olam Haba the personal salvation that pertains to the individual after leaving this world behind? Or is it a transformation of this world when this world attains its final destiny in completeness and perfection? Obviously, the former pertains to the question of an individual's salvation, everlasting life. The latter pertains to the extent to which we, both individually and collectively, are contributing to making that world that is coming come to fruition. It may be noted here that as Ramban, in his premier composition on reward and punishment, the Shar HaGemul section of Torah HaAdam, notes that in Aramaic parlance, the way the world to come is rendered is as Alema De'ate, which more rigorously should be translated not as the world to come, but rather as the world that is coming. When this world is complete and will have reached its final destiny, that will be the world to come. That is inevitably part of the picture. The truth of the matter is that that aspect is probably the easiest aspect to negotiate, simply to the extent that if, when we speak of the world that is coming, we're speaking of the extent to which one can contribute to the final redemption of the world, then on some plane, it not only stands to reason, but is almost inescapable that everyone, in making some potentially positive contribution to the spiritual tenor of life in this world, is contributing to that final destiny. And I'll note in this regard, I have to admit that there are certain core messages that are almost ubiquitous in my presentations to Christian audiences. And one of them is, as we know very well, one of the subjects that divides Jews and Christians is how we view the Messianic era on manifold planes. I'll stress on manifold planes because it certainly is not merely a question of whether he was here already or not. And the way I typically address that issue is by proposing that we leave the whole subject of the Messianic era in the only hands into which it can be entrusted. It is generally superfluous for me to spell out that I mean God. And to further add, as a deadpan, that I'm sure he can handle it well enough without our butting in and telling him what he should do. And to further add to that, as an addendum, that I sincerely believe that on that blessed day, God will know how to give good reward to all those, both Jews and Christians, and others, who helped to pave the way for that blessed day to come. Now, so far, so good. This is relatively powerful. But the question of personal salvation is undoubtedly still a vexing one. Do we regard Olam Haba as something exclusive? Because if we do, then consider, when I come into the room, if I sincerely love my Christian friends, then shouldn't I want to save them? And if I want to save them, then shouldn't I be attempting to persuade them to abandon Christian belief? That's the question that I'd like to consider in the time that we have available now. And I'm apologizing in advance that this is going to be, perforce, something of a flyover, because the issue is so complex and so fraught that focusing, as we really should, on each of the individual trees involved in this question will, I fear, preclude our getting a sense of the forest. So I'd like to share with you a glimpse of the forest, and maybe in the questions and answers afterward we can further elaborate on individual trees to the extent that people are interested in pursuing them further. So, with respect to personal salvation, maybe a good place to start is the first place in our literature where personal salvation is altogether intimated. That was intended as a riddle, by the way. A riddle whose solution is fairly obvious upon reflection. Where's the first place that personal salvation is intimated in the literature? Which literature? Let's start with the Torah. How about Bereshit? Chanoch. Vayitalech Chanoch et ha'elokim ve'enenu ki lakach oto elokim. Chanoch walked with God and was not because God took him. So without getting into all the myriad intricacies of what it means to walk with God and how he did it and what he did, what does "and he was not" mean? He went poof and disappeared? Well, clearly not, because the text then goes on to state, "Ki lakach oto Elokim," because God took him. Where did he take him? So while I freely concede this is by no means an overt, explicit statement on the subject, I think we could fairly agree that it is a transparent intimation of belief in something that goes beyond this world. I'm pointing this out, of course, because it's good to note that the first biblical reference, at least intimation, of everlasting life has nothing to do with affiliation in Am Yisrael, because Chanoch wasn't affiliated. Simultaneously, of course, we could note that, well, Chanoch is, after all, part of the genealogy that leads to us. And the Mishnah, at the beginning of Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin, famously states, "Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelek olam haba." All Israel has a share in the world to come. Exclusivity. No. No. Because, of course, inevitably, it's always critical to not wrench statements out of their context. So when you consider what the context is, the Mishnah begins by telling us that all Israel has a share toward the world to come, and then listing those who do not. And on the list of those who do not, the rogues gallery, the individual who is particularly germane for the purposes of this discussion is Bil'am. Now, if I were to make a statement like, all fruit will be served as refreshments, I would not then go on to say, and not steak. A simple enough example. Steak wasn't included in all fruit, so there's no need to state that steak is an exception to fruit. If all Israel had a share in the world to come, why do you have to tell me that Bil'am isn't included? It's a good question, a good enough question, that the Gemara asks explicitly on that opening Mishnah of Perek Chelek, and concludes that the Mishnah, perforce, must accord with the position of Rabbi Yehoshua, who, as opposed to Rabbi Eliezer, posits that Chasidei Umot HaOlam, the pious of the nations of the world, have a share in the world to come. So once we recognize then that the pious of the nations of the world have a share in the world to come, and to that extent then Kol Yisrael does not only refer to all Israel, but also others, so it's important for the Mishnah to tell us that Bil'am does not rank as one of the pious of the nations of the world. He is one of the wicked of the nations of the world, and as a result, he doesn't have a share in the world to come. But of course, then the Gemara's conclusion, again, according with the position of Rabbi Yehoshua, is that we are not exclusivists with respect to a share in the world to come, as demonstrated by the fact that Bil'am is someone who needs to be excluded, because the pious of the nations of the world have a share in the world to come. That the pious of the nations of the world have a share in the world to come, in later literature, is deemed axiomatic. That is, for all intents and purposes, although it is for the purposes of completeness, appropriate for us to recognize that there is the position of Rabbi Eliezer who dissents, Rabbi Yehoshua's position is universally accepted. The pious of the nations of the world have a share in the world to come. And indeed, if we ask why that should be so, I would first cast it in fairly basic conceptual terms. And that is, what does everlasting life presume? What I mean by that question, on the most rudimentary plane, is that we are not merely subject to the laws of physics. If we were subject to the laws of physics only, then everyone knows that among the laws of physics there is, to be a bit technical here, the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics tells us entropy tends to increase, that is, disorder increases, things fall apart. So your car breaks down, your computer crashes, and your body progressively decays and disintegrates. And if all that a human being is physical, then a human being is subject to the laws of decay that pertain to the car and the computer and everything else in our lives. Everything physical in our lives decays and eventually disintegrates, and so do we. If we are mere physicality. But to the extent that a human being is not mere physicality, there's no reason to presume that that which is not physical would be subject to the laws of physics. And indeed, in this regard, we should note that Ramban in particular, the idea is certainly intimated in earlier sources as well, but Ramban particularly accentuates it, stresses that the reticence of the Torah in speaking explicitly about the world to come is a reflection of this idea being so axiomatic it doesn't demand elaboration. That a human being dowered with a soul would transcend the bounds of physical death, that's obvious. So what does the Torah emphasize? The Torah emphasizes there isn't even such a thing as reward in this world. But there is a reward that transcends the bounds of this world is as obvious as recognizing that a human being transcends the bounds of his own physicality. Well, taking that as the underlying premise for everlasting life, it should be clear to us there's certainly no reason to think that there would be any exclusivity in a share in everlasting life for Jews alone. And this, arguably, is perfectly explicit in the Mishnah. That is, when Rabbi Akiva tells us, Chaviva Adam Shenivra V'Tzelem, precious is man in having been created with the essence of God. He isn't talking about Israel. Besides the clear implication of the text, the next line makes that conclusion arguably inescapable. I'm stressing this point because there are those who, for reasons that elude me, nonetheless refuse to see this as what the Mishnah is stating. But if the Mishnah then goes on, after speaking about beloved, precious is man, to say beloved, precious is Israel in being called children of God. Banim atem Hashem Elokechem. Okay, then the second part of the Mishnah is talking about Israel. The first part is talking about man. All men. All humankind. All humankind is endowed with that imprint of the divine, that Tzelem Elokim. Whatever it means, it is indeed that spiritual essence that animates all human beings. And indeed, this is what the Sforno states explicitly. He states it on last week's parasha, in speaking about the summons of Yisrael to be the segula, the designated royal property of God, Kili Kol Haaretz, for all the earth is mine, says the Sforno, and he quotes this Mishnah in that context, Kili Kol Haaretz, because all the world is mine, and the pious of the nations of the world are undoubtedly precious to me as well. So of course, again, on this plane, it should be patently clear. Spirituality is under no circumstances something over which we exercise a monopoly. And indeed, the Midrash in Tana Devei Eliyahu states this arguably even more emphatically in a somewhat different domain, in stating it as a categorical verity that for all human beings, explicitly, whether Gentile or Israel, according to the deed that one does, so the Holy Spirit, Ruach HaKodesh, comes upon the person. There is no exclusivity here at all. And to the extent that we appreciate that Ruach HaKodesh is clearly a spiritual endowment, there isn't any monopoly on spiritual endowments that is bequeathed to Israel. So of course on this plane then, the capacity to be able to attain a share in the world to come is one that is certainly exercised by the nations of the world as well. The question inevitably arises, to what extent and under what circumstances? And here, inevitably, there is a whole domain that needs to be explored further. Because classically, when we speak of those who are characterized as Chasidei Umot HaOlam, the pious of the nations of the world, the simple correspondence between individuals among the nations of the world and that label pertains to observance of the Noahide laws. The Noahide covenant, which comprises six prohibitions, a prohibition on murder, a prohibition on theft, a prohibition on sexual immorality, specific forbidden relationships, a prohibition on eating a limb torn from a living animal, a prohibition on idolatry, that is, deifying that which is not divine, a prohibition on blasphemy, cursing God in God's name, which is essentially absurd. Those six prohibitions, and a seventh to enforce the other six, to the extent that one upholds that Noahide covenant, unequivocally such an individual is deemed to be among the pious of the nations of the world. And I reiterate, given the extent to which Rabbi Yehoshua's position that the pious of the nations of the world have a share in the world to come, given that that position is ubiquitously embraced, no one would question that. What we need to explore further is, A, what about individuals who may less formally be aligned with observance of the Noahide covenant? And B, what indeed constitutes observance of the mitzvot that are included in the Noahide covenant? So I'd like to begin with A, because in order to extract as complete a picture as possible from the foundations in Talmudic literature before we embark upon considering their implications in rabbinical literature, there is an additional domain that at the very least briefly needs to be introduced. So far, we've taken the Talmudic literature in stride in a fairly concrete, explicitly delineated, halachic framework. But there is, inevitably, also the non-legal domain of Talmudic literature, the Agadah. And while going through the gamut of sources that are relevant here in the Agadah would require more time than we have available, I do feel compelled to share with you that there is a whole spate of sources that we find throughout Talmudic literature speaking of individuals who not only were not Jewish, but who clearly were not particularly scrupulous in their observance of the Noahide covenant having a share in the world to come. Maybe for the purposes of this discussion, we should restrict ourselves to one particularly glaring story. The story is told regarding Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion in Tractate Avodah Zarah on page 18a, that when the Romans caught him in violation of their prohibition on teaching Torah and wrapped him in his Sefer Torah and burnt him alive, the executioner, who had been charged with prolonging his agony by keeping his torso surrounded with tufts of wet wool so that he wouldn't expire quickly, asks Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, if I take away these tufts and shorten your anguish, will you bring me into the world to come? And Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion promises that he will. Swear to me, he swears to him. And the Gemara tells us that he increased the flames and took away the tufts of wool from upon his heart, and Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion immediately expired, and the executioner immediately jumped into the pyre himself and was incinerated. Besides the fact that he was an executioner, so he was not merely by avocation, but by vocation, a murderer. He was obviously also an idolater. And to top it all off, his final act in this world was committing an act of suicide. Immediately after, that is, his penultimate act in this world, which was an act of homicide. And the Gemara records, Yatz'ah batko ve'amra, a divine echo went forth and it said, Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion and his executioner are readied for life in the world to come. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wept upon this and said, there are those who acquire their share in everlasting life in but a single moment, and there are those who acquire it over the course of many years. He wept, but he wept in the realization that this executioner had a share in the world to come. So clearly then, the bounds of exclusivity are further eroding here. We're not exactly talking about one of the pious of the nations of the world. By pretty much any definition, this is not piety. And yet, it earned the executioner a share in the world to come. There are many other stories that illustrate this principle. We won't go through them now. It would take us too long. But that in itself, coming from the agadic domain of Talmudic literature, clearly broadens the canvas that we need to explore here. So, what do we do with all of this, and how do we integrate it into an understanding of what indeed constitutes the basis of a share in the world to come? And the truth is, there are a number of discussions, deliberations, and dissensions in rabbinical literature that are especially germane here, and I'd like to, again, as part of our flyover, present them to you in more or less rapid-fire succession. Okay, so first major domain of dissension. There is the question of altogether in evaluating whether one has a share in everlasting life, whether the prerequisite in keeping the Noahide covenant is merely their observance. And this clearly seems to be the position articulated by Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi of Maitz in Sefer HaYireim, and that of other authorities, versus a dissenting view articulated by Rambam. Rambam draws a tantalizing dichotomy that, as he noted in one of his responsa, is explicitly not his own, because it comes from an obscure midrash. Admittedly, a midrash so obscure, I'm not sure we would know about it or not that Rambam employed it as the basis of his halachic ruling. Namely, that when Rambam, in the Laws of Kings, the last section of his halachic code, speaks of the criteria for being considered one of the pious of the nations of the world, he stresses that in order to be considered one of the pious of the nations of the world and to have a share in everlasting life, one needs to accept them and do them because the Holy One, blessed be He, commanded us to do them, commanded the nations of the world to do them, in the Torah, and made them known by means of Moshe. But if one keeps the Noahide laws merely by determination of the mind, and not because of subscribing to such a definitive mandate in the Torah, then such an individual, says Rambam, is not considered to be a ger toshav, which in itself accords those who bear that label various prerogatives and privileges that other non-Jews do not have, and is not considered to be one of the pious of the nations of the world, rather one of the wise, the sage of the nations of the world. Now, I do feel compelled to add here that there is a view explicitly articulated by Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook in one of his letters that proposes that Rambam is not coming to deny to the Chachmei Umot HaOlam, the sage of the nations of the world, the share in the world to come, but rather on the contrary, that the sage of the nations of the world are on an even higher level than the pious of the nations of the world, which certainly is a position that would jive with Rambam's view in many other contexts, that if a person understands something as an intellectually compelling doctrine, he is on a higher level than one who subscribes to something merely because it was taught as part of the tradition. With all due respect, I have to admit, and this is a much longer discussion than we can accommodate right now, that I don't think Rambam's words are readily amenable to Rav Kook's interpretation. And certainly classically, Rambam's view was taken as more exclusivist. That is, you need to subscribe to the Noahide covenant because it is part of what was revealed in the Torah. Which is again the view that is expressed in this relatively obscure Midrashic work that Rambam named as his source, Mishnat Rabbi Eliezer. So, with respect to this dissension, what have we to say? Two things. First of all, in order to understand the basic parameters of the dissension, I have a pet proposal in understanding why indeed Rambam imposes the stricture that he does. And that is something that I would introduce based upon an interesting observation of Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein in the Torah Tmima, where he makes the rather surprising assertion that the seven Noahide laws do not constitute a spiritual framework at all. They are merely intended to provide for the preservation of society. And since they are merely intended to provide for the preservation of society, they have to do with societal preservation, not spirituality. If you ask me, do I think Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein is correct in this assertion? My response is, it depends. And then, once again, my favorite three-word answer. I think it's a machloket. That is, the position of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi of Meitz in Sefer Yireim, I do not think accords with his interpretation. Because among those rabbinic texts that deem mere observance of the Noahide laws to be sufficient grounds to have a share in the world to come, I think the underlying premise is precisely that simply by keeping the Noahide laws, one has vivified oneself spiritually, irrespective of the basis, because they are considered spiritual acts, and that in itself accords to all those who uphold the Noahide covenant, definitionally a share in everlasting life. On the other hand, if you ask me what Rambam's view is, I think what Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein captured is precisely Rambam's view. And I think it's something that is well borne out by many other statements of Rambam in various other contexts, that Rambam really didn't regard society as having any transcendent ontological significance. Rambam viewed society as something that provided for the survival of its members, because in practice, with all due respect to the Robinson Crusoe myth, people cannot provide for all of their existential needs when they are in isolation. Well, if you regard society as merely something that provides for the preservation of its members, then a code of behavior that is intended to provide for the preservation of society is not, by definition, something spiritual. What makes it spiritual? What makes it spiritual is if you're doing it as a spiritual act. In other words, you're doing it not merely to ensure the preservation of society, you're doing it as an act of dedication to God. That's what makes it something that provides the keepers of these Noahide laws with a share in the world to come. Not merely doing them, but doing them as an act of devotion to God because you believe God revealed them in the Torah. I think that as a flyover, provides us with something of a picture of the two views on this subject. And I'm introducing it here because, of course, this is the second reason that I wanted to share this with you. It has fascinating implications with respect to how we relate to, in particular, Christians who are keeping the Noahide laws, as they are. Christians believe that the code of morality comes from God in the Torah. So far as Christians are concerned, indeed, the sanctity of the Bible is unimpeachable. Granted, as a very well-known Dutch evangelist expressed it, this was one of the first times I was speaking to a group of Christians, and I made the comment, holding up my Tanakh, that we stand on the platform of these words together. Yes, Chaim, but our Bible is bigger. And I responded in the same, really, in the context. It was said in a very friendly and even jovial manner. And I responded in a similar tone. Well, first of all, if you really want me to introduce you to everything else that we regard as sacred, Shas and Polskim, Let's see who has more to revere and venerate. But additionally, of course, the second point that I made is, yes, but on this we all agree. And speaking from personal experience, when you quote a verse from Tanakh to Christian believers, they're listening to it as God's revealed will in His Word. I hope whenever I speak to Jewish audiences, they relate to citations from Tanakh with such reverence. So of course, to that extent then, appreciate that Christians really are keeping the Noahide covenant, not merely as ethical humanism. Indeed, they chafe at the very implication that ethical humanism is sufficient to construct the code of morality, because ethical humanism, of course, leaves God out of the picture. And they, of course, decidedly do not. So, that, of course, is inevitably a first consideration in our grappling with the more specific question of Christianity. But in some sense, at least, inevitably, it begs a larger issue. And it is that larger issue that demands of us now taking a hop straight out of the skillet and diving right into the fire. Because if we ask classically in rabbinical literature, how is Christianity evaluated? There is one word more than any other in Hebrew that needs to be invoked and defined here, and that is shituf. Shituf meaning conjoining reverence of God with something else. On the basis that Trinitarian belief is in Jewish sources regarded veritably definitionally as shituf. Christians, of course, regard Trinitarian belief as entirely monotheistic. We have a more exacting standard for defining monotheism than that. And to the extent that Trinitarian belief, from a Jewish perspective, is not purely monotheistic, do we deem Christianity to be Avodah Zarah? And there are a number of passages that are crucially germane in our contemplating this subject. The first that I feel compelled to introduce is, ironically, specifically, Rambam. Rambam, in his halachic code, at the beginning of the second chapter of Hilchot Avodat Kochavim, the laws of idolatry, explicitly relates to any veneration of anything, even if it is as minister, proxy, addendum, what have you, venerating anything in addition to God, constitutes Avodah Zarah and is categorically, from Rambam's perspective, forbidden to all, not just to Jews. Because again, Avodah Zarah is one of the critical six prohibitions of the Noahide covenant. It's important for us, for the purposes of our discussion here, perhaps to stress why I am not going to translate Avodah Zarah as idolatry. Because when we think of idolatry, we think of you whip out your little icon and start bowing down to the icon. Avodah Zarah, translated literally, means just as Avodah is serving God, Avodah Zarah is alien service. There's something alien about the service. If one venerates something alien in addition to God, that, from Rambam's perspective, constitutes Avodah Zarah. Plain and simple. And so, it should not come as a surprise to anyone that Rambam relates to Christianity explicitly as Avodah Zarah. He states this in his commentary on the Mishnah. He states it in the uncensored versions of his halachic code, in Hilchot Avodat Kochavim, in chapter 9, halacha 4, but don't bother looking for it in the standard European editions of Rambam's halachic code, because either it will be distorted beyond recognition, or, as I've seen in many European editions, very simply, the halacha that comes after number 3 is number 5. There is no 4. So you know there's something missing, but it's not there. The Rambam clearly relates to Christianity as Avodah Zarah. He makes this unambiguously clear. How do we relate to that conclusion? And of course, it's obvious implications with respect to a violation of one of the Noahide laws. And the first point that I feel compelled to introduce here is a discussion that pertains to a passage in the Gemara. This is in Tractate Chulin on page 13b, where the Gemara states, Nochrim, aliens, Shevichus Laretz, outside of the land of Israel, Lav Ovdei Kochavim Hem, Ela Minhag Avotayhem Bidehem, are not to be deemed idolaters, but rather are keeping the custom of their forefathers. Now, the truth of the matter is that if I were disingenuous, I would attempt to make much more capital out of this Gemara than it warrants. Because it's not coming to tell you that any heathen outside of the land of Israel is a glatt kosher observer of monotheistic doctrine. What the Gemara means in its context is that inasmuch as the heathens outside of the land of Israel are not so wholly dedicated to the religious practices in which they are engaging, you need not fear, this is the specific context of the Gemara statement, that if you give a gift to your heathen friend on the day of his holiday, that he's going to immediately go into his idolatrous shrine and express his thanksgiving by engaging in forbidden service
of his pagan deity. Why would you care? Why would you care altogether about his going in to say thank you to his God? You would care because, again, Avodah Zarah is something that is forbidden not only to Jews, but also to non-Jews. Now let's talk about something that's forbidden to Jews. In Parashat Kedoshim, we read, Lifnei iver lo titen michshol. You shall not place a stumbling block before the blind. In our tradition, that prohibition has little to do with physical stumbling blocks or visually impaired people. It is a prohibition to cause someone to stumble by violating a prohibition. If a person sins due to your action, you've done something wrong. You have abetted that crime. That doesn't only apply to your causing your Jewish friend to sin. That would also apply to your causing your non-Jewish friend to violate one of the Noahide laws. He's not allowed to violate those laws. You're not allowed to abet his violation of those laws. I'm noting this because this is going to, as we'll see in another couple of moments, play a critical role in an additional arena in this discussion. But with respect to the Gemara's formulation, to not give gifts to a heathen who is going to run into his idolatrous shrine and give thanks, you're not allowed to do it because you're not allowed to abet his engaging in idolatry. Yeah, but the Gemara then says, with your pagan friends outside of Eretz Yisrael, not to worry, they're not so frum. So they're not going to run into the idolatrous shrine to give thanks. And as a result, what's the context of the statement here? As a result, you are only forbidden to give them a gift on the day of the festival, as opposed to with the real frummies, you're not allowed to give them a gift even 3 days adjacent to the festival, because they might still be giving thanks on the pagan festival for the gift that you gave. Okay, so of what relevance is this kind of discussion? The relevance is not so much from the Gemara. The relevance is how this statement is treated in rabbinical literature. Because in the time of the Rishonim, the early rabbinical commentators, the early rabbinical halachic deciders, it was practically ubiquitous, as they state, that people were giving gifts to their Gentile friends and neighbors, even on the days of their festivals. Now, if that would have been happening nowadays, we all know very well what would happen. We would just put everyone in cherem. But in those days, the presumptive assumption was that if everyone is doing something, there's probably a legitimate basis for it. And the emergent answer that we find among veritably all those who weighed in on the subject is that we don't relate to the Gentiles among whom we reside nowadays as idolaters at all. And since they are not of the Avodah Zarah, therefore, there's no problem. Because the prohibition, even on the day of the festival itself, was a situation-specific prohibition that pertained only to someone who was engaging in idolatry. And if you know the person isn't engaging in Avodah Zarah of any sort, no alien service, there's no prohibition. So consider already at this stage the manner in which the Rishonim, the early rabbinic commentators, related to their Christian friends. They were not deemed to be of the Avodah Zarah. Now this is more on the level of a general statement, but now it's important for us to get much more specific, because this is really the guts of the issue, and perhaps the premier presentation on the subject that manifestly dissents with the position of Rambam. Because, again, as we noted a few moments ago, Rambam categorically relates to shituf, again, conjoining God's name with something else, as Avodah Zarah in every sense. And as a result, he says Christianity is Avodah Zarah. And then we have the position of Rabbeinu Tam, as presented in the Tosafot. This is a position that is presented three times in the Tosafot. To summarize it in brief. First, background in the Gemara. Another expression of the self-same prohibition Lifnei iver lo titen michshol. To not make a stumbling block for the blind is that the Gemara institutes a prohibition on entering into a business partnership with an oved avodah zarah, with an idolater. Why? Not because of this discrimination. On the contrary, because again, you have responsibilities to your fellow human beings. And just as you aren't allowed to cause your fellow Jew to violate one of the mitzvot of the Torah that pertain to him, you aren't allowed to cause your Gentile friend to violate one of the seven Noahide laws that pertain to him. What's the problem here? The problem here is, nebuch, when people get involved in business partnerships, what happens next? They get into a fight. What happens after that? They go to court. They go to court, and the judge is liable, in the context of the litigation, to demand of the litigants to swear. And if you cause your Gentile partner, by holding him to court, to swear in the name of Avodah Zarah, then you're causing him to violate one of the seven Noahide laws. Because that's Avodah Zarah. To swear in the name of Avodah Zarah is to express his allegiance to his Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to do that. So of course, parenthetically, just consider this. You're not only talking about someone who is a pagan, who is an idolater, you're talking about someone who is a cheat. He's stealing you from you. If you weren't stealing from you, you wouldn't have brought him to court in the first place. And still at all, you're not allowed to cause him to swear in the name of his pagan deity. So that's the context of the Talmudic rule that as a result forbids your entering into a business partnership with a non-Jew. And once again, the premise in the time of Rabbeinu Tam was entering into business partnerships with non-Jews was routine, it was ubiquitous. What's the justification and the formulation employed in this context by Rabbeinu Tam? I'd like to read it to you verbatim because there's a certain element of nuance here that demands explication. Peresh Rabbeinu Tam explained, "Bisman hazeh kulam nishbaim b'kodashim ve'ein tofsim b'hem elohut." That nowadays everyone swears by that which they venerate, presumably in context is referring to the saints, not specifically the Trinity, as becomes clear from the next line. And they don't regard them as divine. There's no problem of them venerating them as gods. And even though they mention the name of heaven and their intention is something else, in some redactions of the statement of the Tosafot, that something else is rendered more explicitly as, and they are referring to Jesus the Nazarite. In other words, again, now we're talking about classic Trinitarian belief. Even though that's what they're doing, Mikol Makom Ein Ze Shem Avodat Kachavim. Nonetheless, this is not considered to be the name of Avodat Kachavim, of any form of Avodah Zarah, ki da'atam l'shem oseh shamayim va'aretz, because their intention is for the maker of heaven and earth, ve'af agav shemishtatev shem shamayim b'davar acher, and even though he is conjoining the name of heaven with something else, ein kan difnei iver lo titen michshol, this is not a violation of the prohibition of placing a stumbling block before the blind, for you, as Jews, divnei noach lohu zerol kach. Because Noahides weren't commanded pertaining to Shituf. And therefore, we're not violating any prohibition by causing them to engage in Shituf. Because the Shituf itself isn't forbidden to them. So if it's not forbidden to them, we're not violating anything by way of placing a stumbling block before the blind. Because we're not causing them to do anything that's sinful to them. This is the position of Rabbeinu Tam. And of course, inevitably, it is germane for us to consider what the basis of this position is. So at least in brief, I feel compelled to share with you at least what the antecedents are for this in our literature, going back to Tanakh. Where do we find the first explicit example of Shituf in the Bible? Sefer Melachim, second book of Kings, chapter 17, verse 24, the 10 tribes, our history. They've been exiled. And in keeping with standard exile policy 101 of the Assyrian Empire. You bring out the indigenous population and bring in another population. So the king of Assyria brings into the land of Israel various other nations from various different places. And you have a problem. Anyone recall what the problem was? Who said that? Let's say it with a roar. Lions! Lions, for your information, can be a problem. The lions were killing them. The Asian lion used to be a native species in the land of Israel. So, what do? They conclude that the problem is they don't know the laws of the God of the land. Which, of course, in context makes perfect sense because you're talking about a bunch of idolaters. And idolatry 101 is every different land has its own territorial deities. So we don't know the laws of this particular territorial deity. So the king of Assyria accedes to the request by sending back one of the Kohanim who had been exiled from the 10 tribes, and he goes and sets up shop in Beit El and teaches them how to revere God. And what do they end up doing? They end up creating an amalgam. In the parlance of Sefer Melachim, et Hashem hayu yireim ve'et Elohim hayu ovedim. They revered God and they served their gods. Ah! Glat shituf. That's exactly what shituf is. They revered God, they served their gods. Parenthetically, if it would have been they revered their gods and served God, I humbly submit that would not be shituf. That would be pure avodah zarah. They only revered God, but they still served their gods. That's shituf. That's conjoining God's name with other things that you regard as proxies, ministers, assistants, whatever. And while it wasn't perfect, what approbation did they get? The lions. The lions laid off. So it wasn't perfect, but it was good enough for the lions. So it was something. And indeed, we'll note that Rabbi Avraham ben Ezra, on last week's parasha, when he talks about the order of Aseret HaDibrot, invokes the story of the Kutim in justifying why the order of the commandments is first Anochi and then Lo Yelecha. Specifically, that Anochi is establishing belief in God. Says Ibn Ezra, there are people who fulfill that first dibur, but who fail in the second one. Because the second one is, you shall have no other gods before me. In other words, no shituf. Okay, well, there are people who indeed fulfill the mitzvah to believe in God, but they still revere other gods. It's better than nothing. That certainly is the position that Ibn Ezra invokes. And I would submit that it is in tandem with that position that we understand Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Natan says also, it's better than nothing. It's not considered Avodah Zarah. It's something that is indeed better than Avodah Zarah. And according to Rabbi Natan, it's even permissible to non-Jews. Now, I have to admit, in the interest of full disclosure, and I realize I'm bucking a time limit, but in brief, that an additional ancillary dissension that pertains to the position of Rabbi Natan is when Rabbi Natan said that Shituf is not forbidden to the Gentile world, was he referring to venerating God plus something else, or merely the act of verbalizing an oath in the name of God and something else? You could read Rabbi Natan in the latter sense, and the position that is articulated by a number of eminent later rabbinical authorities is it must have been the latter. Because how can we imagine that Rabbi Natan would allow non-Jews to engage in what constitutes idolatry? It would still be Avodah Zarah. If it's Avodah Zarah for us, why shouldn't it be Avodah Zarah for them? There is that position. But I feel compelled to share with you. Number one, we rule halacha based upon Rabbi Moshe Isserlish, the Rama. Now, I'm going to give you a case that the Rama addresses, and you tell me what its implications are. The case is whether a Jewish tailor is allowed to sew the vestments of the priests, the Catholic priests. And the Rama says it's permissible for the same reason that engaging in a business partnership is permissible. You follow that? The Ramah is obviously ruling according to Rabbeinu Tam. But he's also clearly understanding Rabbeinu Tam's position as having nothing to do with an oath, because sewing vestments and wearing those vestments afterwards in engaging in Catholic religious ritual has nothing to do with an oath. Clearly the Ramah held that Rabbeinu Tam is talking altogether about the act of venerating God and serving something else. If that's what Trinitarian belief constitutes, as he presumes, as pretty much everyone presumes, that it does, it is permissible for Christians. It's not considered avodah zarah for them, which is why it's not a violation of a stumbling block for the blind for us. And this position is likewise embraced by Rabbi Shabtai Kohen, the Shach, one of the primary halachic deciders with respect to matters of that which is prohibited and permitted. And finally, the icing on this particular cake is the position articulated by the Vilna Gaon, with the Vilna Gaon in Be'ur Hagra on Yoredeya provides the tacit rebuttal of everyone who would claim that the prohibition of Avodah Zarah should be identical to non-Jews and therefore include Trinitarian belief. Says the Vilna Gaon, yeah, but we learn the prohibition of conjoining God's name to something else in the Gemara, and here's the Parsha connection from the verse that we will be reading on Shabbat. Shemot chapter 22, verse 19. That if one brings an offering to Elohim, to any Elohim, then one is subject to destruction, only to God alone. Says the Gra, says the Vilna Gaon, even that doesn't pertain to the prohibition of idolatry as part of the Noahide laws. That's a special prohibition that was given to the nation of Israel. Okay, well, the nation of Israel has 613 commandments, and this is one of them. It doesn't change that which is forbidden to the nations of the world, who are held to a less exacting standard than that which pertains to Israel, and therefore the nations of the world are not violating the prohibition of idolatry when they engage in Trinitarian belief. Now, I do feel compelled to go back for a moment to the major dissenting view. Remember? Rambam. Rambam said that Shituf does constitute Avodah Zarah. And I feel compelled to share with you my personal take on why that is Rambam's position. Anecdotally, I have a very good friend who is an eminent professor of Jewish philosophy at Hebrew University, who said to me that he thinks Rambam related so dimly to Christianity because Christians in his time were a bunch of backward barbarians. And I said to him, with all due respect, I disagree. I think Rambam would relate to Christianity exactly the same way today. Why? Because of God of the Perplexed, Unit 3, Chapter 51. Where Rambam says that if someone engages in serving God without having come to knowledge of God, you know what he's serving? He's serving, says Rambam, a figment of his imagination. Because having not come to knowledge of God, there is no existent that corresponds to what he thinks is the object of his service. In other words, if an individual is engaging in an intellectually flawed service of God, that is avodah zarah. That's alien service. So of course, by the logic of Rambam, then, we can appreciate Ramban in the Barcelona disputation, at the end of the disputation, relates to Trinitarian belief as something that makes absolutely no sense. And when Pablo Cristiano, Yimach Shemo, says, no, you have to realize that Trinitarian belief is something that's so subtle and so complex, even the ministering angels don't understand it, says Ramban, okay, well, since it's obvious that a person cannot possibly believe in something he doesn't understand, that means the ministering angels also don't believe in the Trinity. End of discussion. Which was, by the way, an idea that Ramban clearly appropriated from Rambam says in Unit 1, Chapter 50 of the Guide, that you can only speak of believing in something that you can comprehend. So given that, says Rambam, Trinitarian belief doesn't make sense. It's not intellectually compelling. If you understand what you mean by God, venerating anything other than God and thinking that God has components that can be subdivided is absurd. Therefore, it's not considered serving God. Period. End of discussion. What I feel compelled to add here, and I'll try to say this as delicately and diplomatically as possible, is based upon where Rambam has set the bar, I'm not so sure how much of Am Yisrael would be considered to be serving God either. And as a result, historically, Rambam's view was not accepted as the basis of operative halakha, because the standard is a very high one, and most of humanity can't deal with it. And by consequence, the view of Rabbeinu Tam is the one that has become the basis of halakha. Again, it's codified by the Ramah, by the Shach, by the Gra. In just a couple of additional sentences, there are still a couple of additional feathers I need to add to our cap here. Besides this question that pertains to Shituf, there is also the approach taken by Rabbi Menachem ben Shlomo HaMeiri, an extraordinary scholar who lived in Perpignan in the late 13th, early 14th century. And I have to tell you that when you consider what Christianity looked like to these people, to be able to have any kind of conception of a better Christianity than what they were experiencing, to me, leaves me speechless. Says the Meiri, and he explicitly relates to Christianity as not being Avodah Zarah, that altogether, everything in the Gemara that pertained to Ovdei Avodah Zarah, what we would render as idolaters, pertains to nations that are not circumscribed in the names of the in the ways of religion. As opposed to Umot HaGidurot B'Dakei HaDatot. Nations that are, that subscribe to the notion of a universal moral code. Says the Meiri, any such nation isn't considered to be idolatrous. That's not Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is specifically this cult orientation that denies the existence of a universal moral code altogether. And while, admittedly, you will find those who tend to explain away the Meiri nowadays as, oh, he was doing that because of the censor, I'll share with you just one very short example from the Meiri in which this principle is involved. The Gemara states, this is a very familiar statement at the end of Masechet Shabbat, Ein mazal Yisrael, which doesn't mean that Jews don't have any luck. It means that Yisrael are not subservient to systemic factors that pertain to the celestial realm. Okay, says the Meiri, that applies not only to Yisrael, it also applies to all nations that are circumscribed in the names in the ways of the religion. Say, if the Meiri was writing only because of concern about a censor, there is no earthly way a censor would have been offended by his not leaving that passage untouched. When the Meiri invokes this idea that in the umbrella of Yisrael are included all those who are nations serving with tribes in the ways of the religion, the Meiri is clearly making a statement of principle as to what indeed constitutes Avodah Zarah and what does not. And perhaps most far-reaching of the in this progression is the position of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who posited that the purpose of the founders of Christianity was twofold: to reinforce among Jews observance of Torah and mitzvot, and to establish a new religion for the purpose of institutionalizing observance of the seven Noahide laws. This is a fascinating discussion of itself, which of course is beyond the scope of the time that we have, which I realize is already exhausted. But just to conclude, almost going back to the beginning, we had, after all, noted the Agadic passages that speak of heathens, even the executioner of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, earning a share in the world to come. There is, lastly, the position of the Shvilei Emunah, that any non-Jew who strives to save Jews, and in that manner has advanced the spiritual mission of Am Yisrael, even not by keeping the Noahide laws, by that act alone has earned his share in the world to come, which if anything I think accords much more with the popular usage of the expression Chassidei Mot Olam, the pious of the nations of the world. So then, considering the gamut of these positions, I have no problem telling my Christian friends, I believe you are saved. They believe they're saved for a different reason, but I believe they're saved because what our traditions teach me, what all these sources convey to me, is we can indeed rightly expect to see our Christian friends in the world to come.
and we can come into the room and finally confront the elephant. Thank you.
I want to once again thank Rebbe Eisen. We're going to have time for one or two questions. Hopefully have an opportunity for more afterward as well. Just a couple quick notes before we get to the questions. Everyone is welcome to having our next Shabbat Shaluach, the Shabbos, immediately following Purim. It's March 6th and 7th, so we have two people here. Everyone's welcome to join. Also, please feel free to RSVP for Rebbe Sacks. RSVPs are closing in just under 3 weeks. March 2nd, but space is filling up pretty quickly, so I encourage everyone, if you haven't yet RSVP'd, it's going to be Monday, March 16th, and it's easy to find through the school website, so I encourage them as well. Questions?
Okay, thank you very much for coming here. It's a very insightful discussion. A question a little different from what we discussed. Actually, you mentioned, I'm sure you've met many, many Christians. And you mentioned at the beginning that you were meeting with Friends of Israel. And there are many such Christian organizations, Kufai Christians, and Support of Israel, Friends of Israel. And but I want to ask you, some people think that these groups, they're supporting Israel, but they're doing so with the end result that they want all Jews to come to Israel because they want to everyone to be converted to Christianity. My question to you is, do you believe that's the case, you know, based on what you know, like your networking with Christians, do you believe that's the case? And if you do, do you think we should still embrace these organizations supporting Israel?
Okay, first I feel compelled to share with you that this is a domain of almost relentless argument between me and my right-hand man in the running of our website, which, by the way, have cards, yeshivatsharashim.org, one of the modules of which is Bible study to a general audience, specifically for a Christian audience. And this young man is a devout Christian believer in the Netherlands, and he is extremely intolerant of Christians who have this goal that all the Jews should ultimately embrace belief in Jesus. And an argument is, I say to him, you're not being fair. That's foundational Christian belief. If you don't have it, then you're the exception. But a Christian, obviously, believing as a Christian does, will believe that Jews will ultimately embrace belief in Jesus, just as Jews, as believing Jews, will believe that when Mashiach comes, Christians will recognize it wasn't Jesus. And we certainly can't fault someone for maintaining the essential foundational beliefs that they have if we're going to be able to come into the same room and face up to the elephant. Simultaneously, what I will stress is, and this really pertains directly to my comment about we entrust Mashiach in the hands of God. I draw a very keen line of demarcation. I will not work with a Christian organization that has not explicitly and indeed ideologically repudiated evangelizing Jews. The organization that I mentioned, which is a European organization, Christians for Israel, there are a million different flavors here. There's Christians United for Israel, Christians Friends for Israel, Christians This for Israel, Christians That for Israel. This is Christians for Israel. It's a Dutch-based international organization. They indeed ideologically oppose evangelizing Jews, and indeed as a result do not operate any office in Israel, because in Israel they operate only through existing religious Jewish organizations. So there won't be any basis for suspecting them of impropriety. That, to me, is a crucial question. And I should note, apropos of what I stated earlier, you know, when I speak to Christian groups, I tell them about why I believe, as a committed Jew, that they attain salvation as Christians, and then I go on to say, and what Jews are still waiting to hear from many of their Christian brothers is precisely a reciprocal statement to us, that Christians aren't attempting to convert Jews to Christian belief. But that's with respect to the here and now. And that is a challenge, I will note,
more for Christians in grappling with their sources than I think it is for us, although there are double solutions in that regard. I can elaborate them maybe privately afterwards. I don't want to take time on that right now. What I will stress, however, is that my concern is only if they're attempting to evangelize Jews now. If they're going to tell me that La'atid lavo, in the future to come, Jews will believe in Jesus, I'll say, let's leave La'atid lavo in God's hands. I know that's what you believe. You know that I believe the opposite. And let God figure things out. I'll add here an additional statement.